Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Steve White. He's the Fundraising, Data Strategy, and Insights Manager for Marie Curie UK. Steve describes himself as a data analysis specialist who loves solving complex data problems to provide quality information necessary for organizations to move forward. His ability to draw remarkable and revealing insights from fresh analysis has influenced business decisions at board level in organizations like British Airways, Eurostar, and leading UK charities. As we'll hear, Steve's career path has also included agency side and even founding an agency. But Steve left the agency world to work directly for a charity, joining Marie Curie. There, his team's goal is to deliver robust and insightful analysis to enable fundraising staff to make better data-driven decisions. So it's good to finally have the voice of the charity sector on our podcast. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Paul. I'm really looking forward to chatting to you about my career across a variety of sectors, travel, defence, manufacturing, as you say, very recently, the charity sector for the last 18 years or so.
Great. Thank you, Steve. I'm looking forward to it too. I think a lot of our listeners will really relate to aspects of your career story as well. So I'm keen to get into that and your passion to focus on making a difference. You're actually the first person I've interviewed on this podcast who has a job title of manager rather than head of, director, or something big and impressive. And I'm sure that's a topic we're going to get back into as well and explore that, given all your experience. But let's start with hearing a bit more about your career story. Could you tell us a bit about your background and how, with all this experience, you ended up working at Marie Curie?
Yeah, sure. I think it all started actually almost drawing a circle around Hemel Hempstead. Sounds really silly. 19 years ago, and I thought I need to go somewhere, 100, 200 miles away from home and experience life elsewhere. And I chose a scientific sort of business degree at Salford University in Manchester. Mm-hmm. Experienced life up north, not knowing at that age kind of what you wanted to do, although maths was my strong point. And to cut a long story short, I really enjoyed this business operational course, as it was called, lots of computer programming, operational research, statistics, and it led me to a path of doing an MSc of an operational research at Southampton as well to carry on my studies. And I did have a year and a half or so as well as an IBM placement student during that period as well, which maybe I'll come back to, but was also an influence on my career. Then there was a kind of recession as well when I graduated around, I can't remember exactly when, 1991. And I was fortunate at that time to get a first graduate job in the Ministry of Defence. So I was presenting lots of analysis, if you like, to naval commanders and captains, and quite daunting actually, because they know obviously far more than you do in some respects about how the world of warfare works. And again, I'll come back to how I've moved from quite a diverse background there and presenting, which I found really daunting in those days, to something now where I feel far more comfortable talking about the analysis in the charity world. But I kind of want to reflect on that perhaps in our chat as well. And then after a couple of years there, I finally got into British Airways. I say that because it took me 3 attempts, and I feel quite proud. And, you know, perseverance is also quite an important thing to have as a personality trait. But it was something I always wanted to join, and I ended up in the operational research department. Mm-hmm. Something that I set myself a goal for 3 or 4 years to get into prior to that. Mm-hmm. Found myself on day one in Gatwick Airport doing check-in surveys. 3 or 4 years of data analysis, operational research, reviewing problems like check-in queues, should we make them uni queues, introduction of self-service kiosks in some of the Heathrow terminals, mm-hmm. and also working on one of their traditional problems about how many seats you can allocate on a long haul, short haul aircraft, versus leaving some free for the people who turn up in check-in as well. So one of those kind of optimization problems. And then operational research department in those days, and I'm sure it still does, encourages their staff to rotate around different areas of airports. So
good.
I then had a bit of an epiphany moment where I joined the marketing department. And I guess my first exposure of marketing databases and analyzing the frequent flyer program. And I think something in my mind clicked at that very moment about databases and where I wanted to focus my career. I don't know if I'll just carry on summarizing how.
Please do, Stevie. You got me so far. There are lots of interesting themes, but as you say, let's come back to them and hear the flow of this story, because I'm hooked so far.
Yeah. And I think I also, in those 3 or 4 years where I was analysing the Executive Club Frequent Flyer program, I say my first exposure to databases properly, but I also had a moment where it's the first time I was really presenting, I suppose, to more senior people a lot more frequently. And I got myself involved in quite a lot of stakeholder engagement. And I do remember one moment where, for the first time ever, I suppose, I had the confidence to speak up in a meeting and say, you can do all this wonderful analysis, but actually, how about doing a really simple solution to all of this, which is to essentially simplify all the world traveler, short haul frequent flyer points and mileage scheme. What I was working on is a really complex set of rules, really precision amount of points depending on where you traveled around the world. Sort of put my hand up at one moment in one of those meetings and said, I've done all this analysis, but all my analysis points to actually having a really simple set of rules that saves costs, money and difficulty in trying to explain complex set of rules. Let's keep things simple. And again, I'll come back to that, but I felt like I've been quite an introvert throughout most of my career. And as time's gone on, I've learned that speaking up as an analyst can pay real dividends, and people sometimes do listen to, I guess, the quiet people when you have ideas, and it's just building up that confidence throughout my career.
Absolutely. Let's come back to that, Steve. Key point, degree. Go on.
Yeah. And then for family reasons in 2002, I guess I reluctantly left British Airways after several fantastic years and meeting a lot of people and friends who I'm still in touch with now. But we moved to the Southwest for family reasons and landed a fantastic role as head of analysis for a direct marketing agency called Occam. Mm-hmm. I guess if you've heard of Occam's razor and the principle around keeping things simple, that's, I didn't realize at the time, but that's quite a good mantra as to how to live your life as an analyst. But again, we can talk about that, because I do like to try and have a pragmatic approach to my work.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for our listeners' benefit, I'll interject there with the fact you may remember we've had a previous episode with Scott Logie on this podcast, who was also there at Occam. So it's a bit of a joining the dots for the listeners. Please go on, Steve.
Yeah, thanks. And he was my my manager there. He was director of strategic analysis and other things. And we stay in touch this day as well, which is a great thing. You do build up relationships of a number what I would call really valued, friends, and you continue to work with them in different guises throughout the rest of your career. I think that's another tip I can throw in there, is to always have a great network of people that you can exchange ideas with. So in 2002, I had my first exposure to charity databases. And actually, I do remember my very first project, which was here's Cats Protection, well-known charity. And by the way, Steve, can you analyze this entire database, a bit like a kind of audit? And I remember that day really well. And subsequently, you know, I got to analyze, I always say I've analyzed probably over 100 charity databases in my last 18 years, but I particularly remember those early days of looking at World Vision and Dogs Trust and the WWF and Amnesty International and charities like that. And really getting into the complexities of how database structures work and how you can mine it for insight. So 4 years in all told at Ockham, and some wonderful experience of having, you know, not so much a free license because we got to work to objectives, but having the ability to tell charities what's in their database. And in those days, it was quite a new idea to analyze the database inside and out. So I really enjoyed that role. Again, we'll come back to that because I did have, I suppose, a couple of years between Ockham and my next charity exposure where, rather interestingly, I worked for a local manufacturing company, again, analyzing a database, but this time is your classic kind of job shop environment, analyzing widgets and parts and which customers are giving you the best value. And being the marketing director's right-hand man for all things facts and insights in a classic, you know, they're making products and there's a manufacturing plant I was sitting right in amongst while analyzing data. So quite an interesting 2 year experience. But I was missing the charity market. So in 2007, again, through establishing contacts with previous colleagues at Ockham, we co-founded a company called Wood for Trees in 2007. And I had various roles there, including director roles, consultant, but I still kind of at my heart never want to leave the detail. So I was still doing a lot of the analysis and traveling to London every week and almost acting as an external consultant within the charities, but I felt like part of their team. And maybe I'll touch on that again, but I wasn't actually so much worried about the title of director or what the title meant. Even though I was helping to run a company, I was still in my heart a database analyst. And you know, I guess what I'm saying is I felt not so much comfortable with the title of director. It's about where I can make a difference to charities that meant more to me. So again, wonderful experience. Whether it's working at a board level or whether it's doing what I enjoy most, which is going to the charities and working on site. I left that world in 2016 and I kind of developed a bit of an affiliation, a closeness to Marie Curie, the charity. And going there in 2016 was my charity of choice. Something I can't, it's really hard to explain, but the culture resonated with me. It is a highly unusual move, I think, for someone coming from more of a commercial agency background to, I'll be upfront, take a salary drop. But to me, it was more about my life stage, about matching my values to who I am as a person. And it felt like, a really sensible move. And I don't know, I'd be interested to hear if any other people have got similar stories where they've gone from an agency world to a charity, but I've not heard of too many people. And that kind of sums up my career. You know, I've been at Marie Curie now for 4.5 years, loved every minute of it. I guess, Paul, we can explore more as to why I love the charity sector.
Absolutely. Let's do that. One quick aside before I forget, there's a marketing analytics leader and expert on the data governance side as well, a man called Andrew Morgan, who was at Virgin Money, and he moved across to the charity sector similarly. So I must connect you sometime.
That sounds great.
The couple of themes that came out for me, Stephen, thank you for sharing all of that. And I knew that your generous openness on this podcast was going to make it a great conversation. The first one is actually, you've touched a few times on the benefit of, if you like, getting out there. You're obviously very kind of hands-on in the manufacturing business. You've got out and about at British Airways. I'm hearing someone who likes to know what's really going on in the business for your problem solving. You're not just tucked away working on the numbers. Is that something you recognize as important?
Yeah. And it's not something you necessarily recognize when you're in your early 20s and so on and embarking on your analysis career. But I'm a great believer. It's a bit like walking the shop floor sort of analogy. If you're not actually talking to the very people where you're delivering the analysis, I would question whether you really understand the business problem that they're trying to solve. I suppose I've learned also by watching directors and other senior people, you know, I do, when I, obviously before the pandemic, when I came into London for 2 or 3 days a week to work at Marie Curie, and I really hope those days come back. I deliberately, you know, put my holdall down or whatever after traveling up to London, and I would walk the shop floor and talk to the Marie Curie fundraisers and other business colleagues that I'm working with. And it's not just about talking about analysis, it's actually getting to know your colleagues and be part of their team, and just through those ad hoc conversations you pick up what their problems are, and they can lead to further scoping sessions and real projects. So it's absolutely at the heart of what I do, and it's taken me a while to reflect on that, I guess primarily through Ockham and Wood for Trees. You know, I was traveling up to London sometimes a couple of days a week to engage with charities. So why not do that as a full-time job? So it felt natural.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that makes good sense, Steve. And clearly it's come through as a values-based thing for you, the draw to this work in the charity sector. I wonder, is there anything else that appeals to you about working in the charity sector beyond the aspect of you're doing good in the world, if you like? Are there things that are particularly interesting about working in the charity sector?
I think one of the biggest draws to me, you know, I have had this diverse background, both commercial and, you know, IBM IT and manufacturing, as I said, and ministry of defense. But I always come back to the culture and the people. It's a hard one to explain, but for me, the charity sector have the nicest people you'll ever meet. They, you know, they're passionate about the cause that they represent. And I guess it fits to some extent with my slightly introverted nature. I feel comfortable in that environment. I know you've already said don't talk about the difference that you can make, but it's actually kind of true. You also want to be an analyst that does make a difference. And the charity sector is sometimes not rich in assets in terms of data analysts and insight people. So if you were to join a charity, as I've experienced, you can make a real difference from day one, and that kind of feels good as well. You can take ownership and have a level of autonomy, you know, that you perhaps don't experience elsewhere. But I also think having that agency background where, you know, typically working on several projects and you've got several deadlines to deliver to charities, it's really nice to take that kind of working approach and treat it like you're working in an agency, but in fact you're still in the charity. But you know, you learn as an analyst to juggle several projects and several deadlines, and I think it's a really good kind of background to have and apply that to a charity.
Sounds great. Yeah, I hear that completely. And well done for pushing back on me on the make a difference. I get that you can't exclude it. Out of interest then, and this sounds like a great, bringing together the best of both worlds with that mindset and ethos of the agency side and the culture and the difference you can make working on the charity side. For any on this call, listening to this podcast, who might be considering a move to the charity side, is the data good enough? Are the tools good enough? Would analysts be frustrated, or would you say absolutely do it because it's fertile territory as well?
I would say it's an amazing opportunity. It doesn't matter where you work, there are always going to be data quality issues in your databases. No one's going to pretend for 1 minute that there's a perfect database. So there's always going to be problems to unpick. There's always going to be those holy grail projects that no one's ever solved. I think it's an area that's absolutely ripe for strategic analysis and insight and impact in board level. There are, for obvious reasons, challenges if you depending on where you are in your life stage and whether you can afford to make that move. But a bit of a contentious view, but I also think that sometimes it's also better to recruit one or two really good analysts than accept, I suppose, a smaller sort of junior team that, you know, they have their place, and I'm doing a lot of mentoring at the moment, but sometimes it's really good to encourage some experienced people into the sector, and you can learn a lot from what they've applied in the commercial world. And I do know, for example, Marie Curie has recently recruited someone from that sector to work in parallel with me on certain things, and it's been a breath of fresh air that there's now a few of us in the organization talking at a high level about how much of a difference analysis can make. Just hope charities can see the light and invest a bit more going forward. It's not easy for them though, with the budget constraints and what's happened with the pandemic especially has put even more pressure in that sector.
No, I hear that. What wise counsel, Steve, but I hear those pressures, particularly for charities at the moment. I guess another theme that clearly came through, and you referenced it a couple of times as you talked about your career story, was this prioritizing of making a difference and doing work that you love over having an impressive job title. Let's just, again, call it out clearly. Most of the people I'd have on this podcast would be directors or heads of or president or, I don't know, intergalactic leader of analytics. Clearly, you're there in a managerial role. At least that's what it says on the job title. And as you've said, it's kind of taking a pay cut and not appearing to be as senior on LinkedIn or whatever else. Talk to us about that exchange, the decision to prioritize the work that you do and making a difference versus appearing to move up the career ladder, I suppose, or seem more senior.
It's a really tough one to unpick, and as for those that know me, there's always quite a lot going on in my head as well, but it is true, I was uncomfortable with titles like director that I've had in the past, and at the end of the day, after even 30 years or so of being an analyst, it's recognizing that that's who you are, and hopefully I'm a good analyst, and it's kind of core to who I am, even going back to those days when you're doing maths and further maths in your A levels and deciding on your degree. Even as a manager now or in the past as in higher roles, if you were a director, you'd be focusing on managing others, managing stakeholder engagement, running companies and all the stuff, the administration, I suppose, that comes with that. And that's not who I am. I'm fortunate to have a support network, I suppose, in Marie Curie that takes some of the admin away from me and lets me think about how to solve problems. And I guess I liken it to operational research, which is going back to my MSc days of applying maths and science to solve business problems. And I need an environment where I can thrive on that. And, my current role is a perfect example of that. I want to keep learning. I want to, like I have in the last couple of years, learn Power BI, read up on the latest ideas. I actually really enjoy now presenting to directors, but at the same time, 30 minutes later, I'll be writing SQL code in. And, every hour is totally different. And it has taken me 20, 30 years to recognize that's what I do, and not to be preoccupied with promotions and titles. It's also when I'm giving out advice myself to other people, I often tell them to read that book about, what color is your parachute, the classic CV job hunting type job where you have to match your skills to the right sector. And I reflect back on that time, and I am passionate about the charity sector. I'm passionate about the travel sector, obviously, for a while as well. I guess if still had my dream job, it would be analysing, I don't know, a database for Watford Football Club or something. But it gives you an idea of what that essence of that book is about. There's quite a lot of stuff in there around recognising who you are and applying your skills to the right sector for you.
Yes, that makes good sense and good advice. I can hear the mentor in you coming through, Steve.
I more and more of that at the moment.
Good for you. It's so much so needed, and a gift one generation can give to another as well. I'm also conscious it's come up a few times. You've kind of touched on being a more introverted person, certainly earlier in your career, being quite nervous about presenting, and I guess being quite comfortable being by yourself. Do you feel that being introverted has helped or hindered your career?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's helped and it's not helped. And I think if I reflect back to British Airways, I guess I was not confident enough sometimes to go for promotions, while perhaps others at similar skill levels, you know, moved up the ladder. And I guess I didn't know what to think of that at the time, but I enjoyed the technical aspects of analysis and spreadsheeting or SAS programming or whatever it was at the time. And it is actually quite hard to forge a career path, certainly in your early days as being a technical specialist. I'm being quite reflectful of that, but I'm really hoping other organizations do, you know, I'm sure they do now, but understand who perhaps sometimes who their technical experts are, and there's similar rewarding career paths to go that route, because not everybody wants to be a manager or a leader, for want of a better word. It takes a different set of skills, and wherever I've gone, I've always argued I don't actually want to manage anybody until I've developed the technical skills and know-how of how to run and build that team in the first place. I think you get more credibility if you get, if you like, your hands dirty first before considering growing a new team. And that's, again, something that's been quite rewarding for me, is to go into a charity like Marie Curie and build a team from scratch. And rather than, you know, manage the team from the beginning, build the team that I think is right for the organization with a mixture of personalities and so on. I'm just more comfortable being an analyst. I'm more comfortable with who I am. And I think it's okay to be, I guess, introverted, if you like. But, you know, if you are a bit like me, find the right sector where you can still use your skills and have a voice. And so that's why, again, going back to the charity sector, it's actually encouraged me to be more extroverted. And I guess to give you an example of that, to finish sort of this question, is on day one when I joined Marie Curie, I sat in the regular giving face-to-face fundraising team. For those that know charity, that's the team that goes out on the streets and does a fantastic job signing up direct debit donors. No easy job, and you know, it's has good and bad press, and we're not going to get into the politics of that, but I think they're wonderful people, but they're extroverted bunch in general. And I would challenge anyone who's doing data and analyst coding to sit amongst a bunch of face-to-face fundraisers. The experience to me has been a real eye-opener, and also a turning point in, I suppose, in my confidence as well. If you can work with those kind of people and still concentrate on your maths and your analysis, then you can almost work anywhere. And it's actually really good for an analyst to sit amongst fundraisers. Slightly controversial point, rather than sitting in amongst IT people. Because again, going back to that shop floor sort of point, pick up the issues through sitting with the very people that you're there to serve.
Yeah.
I feel so. Hopefully that's quite an interesting story about being introvert, but then the charity encouraging me to be extrovert through sitting around those kind of people.
No, absolutely, Stephen. And I hear the safety net of a culture that made that okay. You know, I can see how that encourages it. But I'm with you completely. I'd encourage, in commercial settings, analysts, data scientists, go and spend a day with the sales folk. You know, you do end up learning a lot and being encouraged in what you can do, I think, by sitting among some of the more extrovert members of your company.
Yes.
I want to pick up on one thing though. I'm conscious that a few times you've almost used a leader and manager as kind of synonymous. And I suppose I'm struck by the fact that a lot of the work that I've heard you've enjoyed and has made a really positive difference, Steve, has been very influential, actually, has helped lead an organization into the right things to do, very much direct the thinking and strongly influence directors, etc. I wonder whether you'd recognize that people can be leaders without managing people. People can be leaders without being senior in the organization because of the very expertise that you've valued.
Yes, another really good question. Again, also to say straight away that throughout my career, I've always been blessed with a way into almost reporting directly or indirectly to the directors at the top. I've kind of see myself as one of these right-hand people that does the maths, I suppose, for some of these senior decision makers. I still go back to my days at IBM, which trying to think of the dates now, I think it's 1989, and I'm still in touch with my very first boss, who was director of procurement there. He's into his 80s and 90s now, but it's great that we still talk on Facebook, and I do identify with leaders rather than managers, I suppose. So throughout my entire career, I'm always mindful of building up really strong relationships with people that I think are really motivating, that lead by the front, and recognize actually the importance of maths and analysis to support their business decisions. Probably going a bit off tangent with your question, but it's quite nice to note really for any future analysts is try and identify those leaders that use your work and buy into the whole thing around they'll take your data and really help them, you know, fuel the insight and change businesses' decisions and processes as a result. I think it's really important to identify those kind of stakeholders.
Completely agree, and I very much support your vision of trusted advisor, right-hand person. I agree that can be immensely influential. And I guess I wanted to call this out because I'm just aware Customer Insight Leader is the brand name of this podcast and of the blog that I publish as well. Yeah. And I never want people to feel excluded from being part of that leadership population just because they're not senior people leaders. I'm absolutely envisioning people also who are influencers, who lead by example, who lead by intellect, who lead by the relationships and connections that they have, because they help the organization make the right decisions, even if they don't have a senior job title. So I guess it's that I was wanting to pull out because I recognize it in you, Steve.
Yeah, and as I say, it's taken me a while to recognize it as well, but I think organizations should allow hopefully many people like me to flourish without, I wouldn't say it's a burden or, you know, managing others, but it's just not my strength. It's nothing worse than, I suppose, having, ultimately it's getting down to the definition of what insight is, which is, you know, changing business decisions further down the line. And if you're preoccupied with managing big teams, to me, that's taking away some of the effect that you can have on organizations. And there's lots of pros and cons, isn't there, as to whether you should have lots of pockets of data and analysis and insight teams across an organization, or whether you should have one kind of centralized team. And probably not going to get into the merits and pros and cons of all of that in this conversation here today, but I'm very much happier not being part of a centralized team, but still being able to influence the organization across the board.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I'll try and resist that rabbit warren, Steve, because
I know.
Similar to you, probably, I've seen and made both models work. I think it's completely contextual. In some situations, one solution can be much better than another, but I don't think it's an absolute rule that one model is better.
Yes. I guess the other point I wanted to make as well, I have a team of three analysts, if you include myself, but we're all very different personalities. And again, that's something that I can reflect on over the many years. I don't think it's actually a good thing to have similar personalities in your team, if you like. I've now got in my team, there's me, and then there's two other people. One's completely extrovert and one's somewhere a bit like me on the introvert scale. And it's really refreshing to actually have a mixture of those kind of personalities in a team. I think, one person who's the extrovert one likes to present along with me and the other one likes to just do the coding. And I think when you're looking at a recruitment and a balanced team, don't always go for the obvious. And actually, I think we'll come on to it towards the end of our chat, but maybe that's the point maybe I'll make when we ask the question about what's changed my mind over the last few years. I've got something very interesting to say later on about that.
Hold on to your horses, listeners. There's something really interesting coming. Okay. Thanks for that, Steve. A couple of things I'll pick up on, actually, because something that's firing off in my head is a couple of blog posts you've made me think about. I remember a while back, Howie Powell, who's on the last podcast episode, he shared a book review of Rebel Ideas by Matthew Syed, a book about the importance of cognitive diversity. And I think it's completely, as you say, different personality types, different ways of thinking are very important in teams, not just appearance diversity, but diversity in the way people think and their personalities can absolutely make them richer. And I'm struck as well, a few things you've said, Steve, have kind of touched on this theme of not failing to have career paths for your more technical people, for those who don't want to go up the man management, to use that old term, route. There is a blog post, I think I called it something like how to protect your technical stars from performance management systems. But it is a problem in lots of organizations that people who are more introverted and more technical either don't have the career paths or aren't really valued and recognized as they should be, because the more senior people or the HR processes don't understand what those people add to the organization. Do you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, I do. It doesn't matter actually where you go. I don't think people get data analysts and insights. And it often, I can't necessarily talk specifically about the charity I'm at the moment, which is a wonderful place, but HR and personnel people probably don't really understand the complexities of the technical aspects of data analysis and insight. And for that matter, if you get the right people on board, the difference they can make to an organization and therefore the commercial value, and even down to remuneration in the charity sector, I would argue that not everybody gets that, paying a decent rate for an analyst. You'll get, potentially someone really, really good if you're prepared to pay the market rate. It's a bit of a trade-off. And HR quite rightly have their own benchmarks and rules, the limits as to how much they can go out and allocate a budget for. But it's a very difficult one. Something I could talk about a lot. And, we struggle, don't we, in most organizations to recruit really good analysts. Something that I don't think in my mind, even in my roles in the agency sector, I still struggle to this day to listen in interviews and spot that potential that we're all looking for when we're building up a team.
It is elusive but powerful, and I agree with your previous point, Steve. It can make a big difference to recruit a more experienced, more capable person, but it can be a financial challenge. Okay, I'm keen to go back to this theme of you being a leader or an influencer, even if you don't think of yourself as a manager. What skills are you still developing as a leader and an influencer yourself?
First and foremost, I'm still learning, and I think never stop learning. I do read books. You mentioned Matthew Syed, and I'm a big fan of his as well. I've read books in the last couple of years, one by a lady called Lisa Schultz, not a well-known book, which is about decisions, not data. I read a Power BI book, which is really sad, or I'm constantly reviewing how I do my presentations. I like to tell stories, Steve White and the Seven Dwarfs has come up a few times for those that know me in the last few years. And I try and be imaginative. And right now, I've identified my number one training development area is to get more understanding of strategy and problem solving skills. I almost feel like I need more and more frameworks as to how to scope and quite complicated analysis problems. So I guess the answer to, you know, what skills am I developing? I'm always developing. And one of the things that I would like to pass on as a, again, as a tip for anybody wanting to either be a fundraising analyst or analyst in general is it's not just about the maths and the analysis and prediction models or whatever they're working on. It's, you've also got to be able to read and write, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. Yes. Reading behind the background on ideas and, but also, you know, I've written a couple of blogs on LinkedIn. I'm not here to plug them, but I find it quite powerful writing stuff down and just reflecting on some, I suppose, top tips that you can pass on to other analysts. I wasn't doing it for me. I'm at that stage of my career where I want to share best practice and share some wisdom on how to become a good analyst. I think it's really important to do, you know, link into that mentoring bit that we said earlier on. That's, to me, that's important to give something back.
Yeah, completely agree. Good for you, Steve. Well, since we're on that topic, I often ask guests on this podcast to spare a little thought for people who are earlier in their career and make some recommendations given hindsight or their experience still of managing people who are relatively new, because some of the listenership to this podcast are younger rather than older, frankly. But particularly given your unique voice, I think, so far, Steve, of really focusing on wanting to stay focused on the technical work, not wanting to climb up the greasy pole, to use that old analogy. Yeah. For those people who might be earlier in their career but think they want to stay hands-on and technical, what would you suggest to them they still need to develop?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. I think anybody who is an analyst, sooner or later, you are going to have to get, you know, build up that confidence to present. You know, there is this, you know, familiar kind of summary of what makes a good analyst, and it is bridging the gap between the technical skills and being able to communicate your analysis to influence decisions. And it comes slowly but surely. But again, using that example from British Airways, having the confidence to speak out when you generally feel that your analysis is showing something, and sometimes showing that simple solution is something that I definitely remember from the past was a turning point in not being that silent person in a meeting when I know I've got something very valid to say based on my data analysis. You've just got to overcome the difficulties of, if you feel difficult in talking to people and presenting your work, because that's ultimately what makes the difference. In fact, I've learned actually that it's almost the other way around now. It could be 30, 40% doing the analysis and 60, 70% of the time communicating the work.
Absolutely.
And so your career will over time flip around, I think, if you have aspirations to go a long way with your analytical insight work.
Go on, Steve, sorry.
No, it's right. One of my other top tips as well I was thinking about was, not everybody gets this, but it might be a harsh thing to say, but you shouldn't think of your work as 9 till 5. I know you got to like your core hours, but I've never done that. And sometimes when you're working on an analysis problem, it can take 10, 12 hours to solve and you're in the zone. And I think sometimes analysts, in order to get on in their career, have to adopt a mindset almost of work hard and play hard. Not all jobs, especially in today's world at the moment, lend itself 9 till 5. And it's not very easy when you're in the middle of solving a problem just to stop work at 5 on the dot. You know, I would encourage analysts sometimes to work very hard for 2 or 3 days or whatever it takes, and then take time off afterwards. And I don't know if that's the same for other types of career, but I found that's always worked the best, is to try and finish something off and do it really well first.
Good advice, Steve. Thank you for sharing that. It's an interesting build, actually, on Harry sharing in the last podcast episode about the need for analysts to put in the time to keep up their personal development as well. Expect to have to be reading and learning almost on top of the day job. So it's a good, honest call out. Thank you, Steve.
I agree with that. And it's like anything, isn't it? If you put the effort in, you're going to get the rewards. And sometimes there isn't enough hours in the working week to fully develop those, I don't know, Power BI skills or you know, the things that I was sharing earlier on. You do actually have to, if you want to have ambitions in career and pass on new skills to other people, sometimes you have to work very long weeks. It's just, I don't know. I like to work hard, not because, you know, you necessarily want to, but it's the way to progress and reap the rewards further down in terms of how you can influence things in organizations.
Yeah, I get that, Steve. And picking up with what you've said earlier, I think when you've makes it even more important that you focused on what you love and what you really enjoy doing, because I think when the work that you're doing is something that excites you and fulfills you, it doesn't always feel like hard work to keep working on something. So I'm with you completely.
I know what you mean, actually. And I guess that's a sign if you are, you know, an analyst is never bored. You know, I think throughout my entire career, I've probably always had a list of 20 or 30 tasks on the go, whether that's further development or reading or just things where I've identified that the organization hasn't said to me it's a priority project, but I'm thinking ahead as to where it might help further down the line. So there's never any quiet time for an analyst, and anybody who ever says that they've got nothing to do as an analyst, I guess I'd put a question mark against that. You can always learn new skills.
Nice. I like it. Nice call out, that one. Okay, let's come to it, Steve. You've bigged it up, so I can't wait. Final question for all my guests. Can you give me an example of something you've changed your mind on in the last few years? What's your big reveal, Steve?
Yeah, thank you for giving me a steer on this question, because this was the one that I found hardest to think of a good example. But I've alluded to it a little bit earlier on, which is around recruiting analysts. And it's really hard to find good analysts. And I'm now, I suppose I had a bit of a moment in the last few years on and off where I've realized that you can look elsewhere for good analysts beyond the immediate set of CVs. You know, just because someone's done a maths degree or they've done a couple of years of data analytics type roles and want to progress their career in their next move, doesn't necessarily mean to say that you should limit your applications to that kind of background.
Okay.
And I've recently heard of one direct success, which is someone that's just been recruited into my team who used to be a sous chef and has no data analytical background, but through the interview process, identified, if you like, the potential, someone who grasped what numbers means and can talk and communicate the numbers to people. And I've also heard stories over the years, and I've seen it for myself, you know, really sort of diverse degrees, whether it's geography background, you know, master chef's type background might be another example. But I guess it's a realization that you can look elsewhere for good analysts. Don't just assume that everybody has to have a maths background, and, you know, good things can be found in unexpected places. And I've also heard recently someone who I really rated as a fundraiser and moved elsewhere to another charity. I rated this fundraiser because they really got data, and now they've become a data analyst in another charity. So I just want to encourage people to think a little bit outside the box when they're looking at the profile of candidates they're getting for recruitment.
That's a great call, Steve. And I remember from my own experience discovering people like history graduates actually being really, really good because they had that fundamental mindset of analytical thinking, which is, I think, is sometimes even more important, that you can think generically, analytically, that you can have curiosity, that you can want to explore, than just understanding the maths and stats. Anyway, I could have chatted to you for ages, Steve. It's been great. Thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure, and I think a very honest conversation, as I knew it would be. Thank you, Steve.
Well, thank you, Paul. I really enjoyed it, and I hope, you know, I've passed on some useful tips for any budding analysis people who've just finished their degree. And I suppose I end on that note, really. My son is rather strangely following exactly the same career as me, having done a master's degree at Southampton. He's just got his first graduate job in data analytics, and I'm hoping if he does listen to this, he learns some things as well. So I'll end on that note, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Steve. There we are, listeners. It's been our first one of a dad on the podcast sending subliminal messages to his son. Thank you also, everybody, for listening. I hope you found that helpful. I hope you found that inspiring, perhaps, to your own career decisions. Please continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. We've got more great interviews coming up. And each week, there's also fresh content on the Customer Insight Leader, alloneword.com site. So please check that blog out too. Before then, thanks everyone for your time. Have a good week. And however locked down you are right now, stay safe, keep well, and bye for now.